was standing. I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I was standing.
I take it you mean jurisdiction.
Yes.
Well, I wondered if we
might. I think standing is an element of jurisdiction. I have a live controversy. What relief can your clients get?
We just want fines, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
We just want to possibly, excuse me for not doing so. This is statutory penalty that we're after. That's all. We've never pled anything else. We don't claim there's any actual harm. Most of the time, people say in this area that it's impossible to plead for actual damages because the statute is so complex and technical, no lay person could possibly understand it. And so the only way to enforce it is with statutory.
But in your case, your client suffered no injury and can't suffer any more injuries because the loan is gone, right? So it's not like they are in danger that the bank will change the method of calculation.
I disagree with that, Your Honor, in the sense that these.
So you think they.
No,
they can suffer.
No, they have. It's elementary that these cases accrue at the time of the violation because they are just statutory penalties, Judge. This is what Judge Warren called the rightness issue. He dismissed it out of hand when it was made below. And the simple fact of the matter is that if somebody violates this, they give you a total statement that happens to be incorrect. That's the point in time when the injury is suffered. What happens later, none of it matters. He's putting pay on the line.
Can Congress simply say it's an injury when you're not in fact injured? It's one thing if you accept a loan and then the bank changes interest in you, or maybe even could. I say, well, you know, they haven't done it yet, but they still have to slow and pay on it. They could change the way they calculate interest. But in your case, the loan is gone, right?
Well, Your Honor, that's something I think is vital to the understanding of this case. Judge O'Scanlon said it best. It's what the contract terms were. We're looking back to old school contract interpretation. What Judge O'Scanlon said in the case I brought to your attention recently with a 28-J letter is if all that counts is what the contract terms say at the beginning, and here the contract terms, because of this arcane bank interest rule, absolutely said that they could charge whatever they wanted to. They could have avoided it in the simplest way by simply saying it was a fully amortizing loan somewhere in the document, or by putting down an additional amount of interest that wouldn't have changed the APR one bit.
Didn't the disclosure list a finance charge?
I'm sorry?
Didn't the disclosure of the document you say was false, didn't it list an amount for a finance charge?
Well, yes, it did, and this is the mirror effect, Your Honor. The fact is that Jella thing doesn't. You can't read it together with the note and say read together. What it means is that the Jella statement limits the legal effect of the note. They're absolutely separate. The only contract term that counts is the contract term in the note. Jella is supposed to reflect the note. They're not read together.
So the note didn't have an amount of the total finance charge?
No, it didn't. All it stated. They don't state it that way. They just state an interest rate, which is, I think, 5.125% here. And the fact is, it's not intuitive. But in the world, and it's been 200 years in the making, we have bank interest, which allows one, when one puts down 5.125%, to actually collect 5.19%.
So what tells us we can't look at both documents together?
This is cited in the briefs, but it's the most basic thing in the method. Professor Harold wrote on truth in lending. The only way from a policy standpoint to make Jella work is to make the Jella statement reflect the terms of the contract. If one could read the two things together, one would never have a Jella violation, but that would require that the consumer understand Jella to the point where they would be able to read those things together, which they normally can't. It just doesn't work.
So in your briefing, you argued that there would be the potential actual harm from holders of due course having such a right to use the 365-360 method. Do you contend that the entity that actually refinanced that loan and
Eric had done to me was to say, look, as long as Chase doesn't intend to do something that controls the situation, well, there's a federal regulation since 81 that said that's not how we do it anymore. They used to look at the actual terms of agreement. So it was a defensive argument to say, look, the intent of Chase doesn't mean very much because these things are routinely sold up at no place else to Fannie Mae. You know, that is the market for home loans, although these forms are used in all kinds of private transactions. I want to make the point to you, this is an entirely technical case. Nobody's saying it's the everybody who's worked with Zillow, and some of you have, understands this is sort of the princess and the pea, and the pea is way down there, and the Zillow is the princess, because no matter how many mattresses you pile on top of the offense, it reaches all the way down if there's an error, and here the error.
But I'm sorry, you told me that the Zillow statement didn't have the total finance charge, but I think I'm looking at it. Isn't it ER-359, and doesn't it say the finance charge is 195.104.49?
Your Honor, I did not mean to communicate that. Of course, it has a finance charge. It is just too low. It's 76.
Exactly. And so if they try to charge more interest, this part of the deal would be incorrect, and then they would have a contract violation, right? They can't do that.
That's wrong. I'm sorry.
Why? Why is that wrong?
So that is not part of the contract. It is.
But so then you also told me the note. So, I mean, they have a contractor once they enter the loan. They have a contract from one of these documents. Oh,
it's
about both.
Yes, it is. We're right down to the critical question. Let me explain it to you. The contract says 5.125% interest. That's what they are obliged to charge. But because of the anomaly of bank interest, which goes back hundreds of years and is recognized by all the courts in this
country. I understand your 365-360 thing, but they can't do it without violating other terms of the same document because the amount would become too much.
No, because the other document, the contract says it has a balloon, but it has a dragnet clause. That is so broad that it absolutely prevents them from waiting until the end of the note and collect the principal at that point.
So what if we disagree with you about that? So hypothetically, we disagree with your contract interpretation. So we don't think any bank could ever charge 365-360 once they've disclosed a finance charge that shows less than that. Do you still have standing? So you're going to lose on the merits. Do you still have standing, or do you not even have standing?
Well, Your Honor, the only, I don't think the arguments are connected. If I lose on the merits, I lose on the merits. I couldn't disagree more that you can possibly make a decision that says what the dragnet clause, that it is possible from contract interpretation, given the ubiquity of 365-360, to say that they couldn't charge X.
So can you tell me what words in this clause you're talking about that would trump a specific number?
Yeah.
So how do you get there?
You have the contract in front of you. There is a provision in that contract that says down towards the end, says if I owe any money on the last day, I will pay.
What are you talking about? Let's look at it together.
Your Honor, I know. Yeah.
You keep the court without your documents. You have the excerpts.
I have my excerpts. I'm looking right at them. Looking at Exhibit 1, this is ER 403.
403.
ER 403.
It's ER 403, says Exhibit 1. Is that right? Are we on the right page?
Well, 403 is Exhibit 1, and there are two more.
I just want to make sure that 403 is your 403. Same thing I'm looking at. It's just the page says Exhibit 1.
Thank you.
Is
that what you're about to
do? Excuse me.
Do you have a page?
I know I can find this. It's there. It's quoted in the complaint. It's just I was caught off guard by the question. I can sit down and find it. It might take me another few moments.
Well, you can move here for the side, and then we'll hear this for a moment.
Fine. That's fine.
But when you come to court, this is the kind of questions we ask. We need to be prepared to talk about the documents. This is the one way in which you can help us.
Of course.
Is by pointing to the things in the document that support your case. This is a close preparation.
I understand, Your Honor. It was so basic that I just thought I knew it, and I made a mistake. Excuse me.
Okay, well, we'll give you this for a moment. We'll let you guys then. We'll hear from the other side.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Jonathan Massey on behalf of Appellee J.P. Morgan Chase. And let me begin by agreeing with Judge Friedland's comments. The loan documents here would not allow any lender to use the 365-360 method. This is a standard Fannie Mae form document. This is Form 3200 that is used for the plaintiff's loan. We're not aware of any lender anywhere who's ever used the 365-360 method of interest calculation under this loan. And the plaintiffs represent a putative class, and they have.
Well, their arguments, I understand it, is they may not have used it, but the loan allows them to do it.
Yes.
And that was not disclosed, and I think that's their argument.
Absolutely.
What is it about the loan documents that precludes them from doing it?
Right. There are several features of the loan documents, and both the note and the deed are in the record, as well as the deal disclosure.
Yes.
So the note itself, which is ER 324, says that the.
So this is a different note in the one.
I'm sorry, this is.
That's fine.
There are just two versions of the plaintiff's complaint, Your Honor. I think they attached the note twice in the excerpt of record, one with the amended complaint. Okay, I'm sorry.
You're not looking at 324.
I was looking at 324, I think, which was the first.
Okay.
The amended complaint.
That's fine. It's 325.
Yes, I think it is, too, Your Honor. I apologize. Well, the note itself says interest will be paid, and then if you look at Section 3, payments, it discusses in Section 3A, I will pay these payments every month until I've paid all the principal and interest, and I will pay them until December 1, 2044. And then Section 3B says the monthly payment will be $1,105.94. And it's undisputed that the loan, the 30-year fixed loan, fully amortizes under the monthly payment specified. That is the.
In other words, if you use 365-360, that monthly payment would be higher.
Correct. It would be the wrong monthly payment. This is a 360-360 monthly payment. That's what Judge Orrick found. That's in the excerpts of record at page 7, which is Judge Orrick's opinion. So
the Spokeo issue is like a mental puzzle here, though, because given for a moment that we agree with you on that contract issue. So does that mean we have to assume for purposes of standing that they don't have a theory at all, or do we give them the benefit of their assumptions on standing that they think you still could increase the amount? So they were injured because they weren't told what their loan involved. So they were injured when they were told the wrong thing. Do we kind of give them the benefit of that theory for purposes of standing, and then they lose on the merits, or is the merits so screwed up here that they don't even have standing?
Well, we do agree that their claim is insubstantial. But before I forget, I want to mention, it's not just the note. In the deed itself, as Your Honor pointed out, there's no balloon payment provision. There's also the deal of disclosure statement that Your Honor mentioned, and there's something called the good faith estimate, which is also in the record. And page 433, all of those documents show there's no balloon payment. This is the amount. How to resolve the case? I would think the easiest way to resolve the case is just to dismiss the appeal, either for lack of standing on the plaintiff's part to continue to prosecute it, since they lost standing when they paid off their loan in December.
Well, see, that I'm not sure I follow you there, because I actually think that he has a good argument that these violations occur when the disclosure happens, and if we grant him the assumptions that this really could have been increased, that he was given an incorrect disclosure, and that's then not accrued then, and there's statutory damages.
We're perfectly comfortable having the court affirm on the ground that Judge Orrick articulated, which is they're on the failure to make the state a claim on the
merits. But Judge Orrick's deal is standing, and we have to deal with standing to figure out if we have jurisdiction, so I don't think we can avoid this Bokeo issue.
Well, if Your Honors, I guess they're standing at two points in time. One is, did they have standing when they filed the complaint, and then did they have standing now? And the standing when they filed the complaint, I think, is a slightly, is a different issue, and in some ways, perhaps, perhaps more generous to them, since there was this speculative future possibility that the lender might change its practices in the future.
At the time they filed their complaint, did they have standing under Spokeo?
We don't even think their claims are weaker than the Spokeo and the Robbins plaintiffs and the Robbins plaintiff in Spokeo, because that person was alleging an actual dissemination of actually false information that affected his employment prospects.
Of course, I mean, you may disagree that it's false, but they think they're alleging a false disclosure to a false statement also.
Well, in the Robbins case, this court just recently on remand identified a number of factors that showed concrete injury on behalf of the Robbins plaintiff. You know, actual anxiety, he was actually unemployed. That's different from the kinds of injuries here. And in our brief, in response to the CFPB's amicus brief, we went through the Spokeo factors, which are the history, common law, and the judgment of Congress. And here in particular, it's clear that Congress did not envision the disclosure of probabilistic, conjectural future events.
But Congress did think that an incorrectly stated interest rate is an injury. And that is their theory. So is that, I mean,
if it's actually applied, certainly Congress is section.
Congress didn't say it had to be applied. I mean, it's the disclosure itself.
Well, in 1601A, the deal with Congress didn't use the word complete disclosure. It said meaningful. And then in the Ford Motor against Mulholland case in 1980, the court distinguished between meaningful disclosure and complete disclosure. And I think Judge Warwick was clearly right to say that there's no duty to disclose a method of interest rate calculation that you're not actually using.
It seems like it does with the merits. So, I mean, right. if we assume this was an incorrectly stated interest rate, I think Congress thinks the disclosure of that, whether it really turns out to be an injury or not, the disclosure itself is an injury because it might affect your loan decisions.
Well, except this is a peculiar claim because it's not that the interest rate is misstated. It's that it might be misstated based on something in the year 2044. But let me just return to the bigger picture. We are comfortable with an affirmance on the merits. That's something that we would advocate. If Your Honors feel the need to address Article 3, we think the simplest way to address it is to ask whether they have standing now. You don't need to ask the question whether they have standing then.
That's right. Still, we have to figure out whether the district court judgment has to be vacated to say never have standing.
Well, I don't think you have to. We would urge you not to vacate. I don't think you have to address that. I mean, I know there's this Steel Company against Citizens case from 1998 that says you have to address jurisdiction first. But then the Supreme Court later in Sinochem, which is 2007, said that the court can look at any threshold issue for resolving a case. With Sinochem, the court said you could dismiss on forum nonconvenience grounds rather than reaching jurisdiction. So we think it would be permissible for this court simply to dismiss the appeal for a lack of standing now without vacating the district court judgment.
Well, they have a claim for statutory damages based on a disclosure that happened a long time ago. How does that evaporate? I don't think a claim for damages evaporates even if something changes later.
Well, because the claim is premised on a speculative future event that might happen in 2044, and now we know that event can never happen. As Judge Kaczynski mentioned, that the clone no longer exists. They are no differently situated than anybody else in the world who doesn't have a mortgage with
Chase. But why is that not failing to state a claim as opposed to having alleged at least a particularized injury that turns out not to be cognizable?
I agree that it shows there's no merit to the claim, and we are not advocating an Article 3 approach here. There's something about quality of gamesmanship where the plaintiff who brings a claim and loses and then pays off the loan and says, now we want to go to state court and incur all the expenses of relitigating. So I don't think our concern is completely unfair. But I do also think, when Your Honors press me, I want to be clear, we believe Judge Warwick was correct. Judge Warwick did not as the opposing counsel pointed out correctly, Judge Warwick rejected our rightness argument, and Judge Warwick addressed the merits. We're perfectly comfortable with Your Honors addressing the merits. If you, when you're asking about the, what I think the appropriate disposition is under the Article III issues, I'm giving Your Honors our secondary points. We are not urging that as the appropriate way of resolving the case, but I do think if you're going to grapple with Article III, the simplest and easiest approach is to ask whether they have standing now, or is the controversy live now, as opposed to what it was in the, when they brought the complaint, just because this peculiar nature of the plaintiff's claim was not that it was, that the finance charge was misstated.
So let me make sure I understand. So let's say we do what you say, and then it's, look, let's say we have no standing now. What is the consequence of that?
I think it's just simply an order dismissing the appeal and leaving intact the district court judgment.
But you agree that if we hold that there never was standing, then we have to vacate the district court judgment?
We hope you would not do that, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal. And
the other question for you. I found the magic beanstalk here. This is ER 324, paragraph 3A. An ultimate sentence that begins, if on December 1st, 2044, I still owe amounts under this note, I will pay those amounts in full on that date, which is called the maturity date.
How is that possibly changing the next B, which tells you how much you owe every month for the life of the loan?
Because under 365, 360, that is a partial statement. They have their, all that is a statement that you have to make a certain number of loan payments.
No, it says the monthly payment will be in the amount of 1105.94. If they did 365, 360, the amount would be higher than that.
If they chose to disclose it, in other words, there's nothing in this contract that says that that is all you have to pay. It's a function of how they
change. How do you read my monthly payment will be in the amount of U.S. 110594 without saying it's an amount you have to pay?
I'll answer more directly. It doesn't say that it's a fully amortizing payment. That's all that's wrong with this note. If the title of the note was multi-state fully amortizing note, they wouldn't have a problem, but fully amortizing is the missing part of the contract. It's as simple as that. There are two ways to fix it.
Is there any case in any state ever interpreting a contract that has an amount of payment that says you have to add extra words to do what you're saying is required by contract? Does any court ever hold that?
I can't go back to my desk and keep looking, but Judge, the 365, 360 thing has been used like that for a
while. I understand it is sometimes used, but I don't think any contract could ever state a payment that's inconsistent with using it and still be a valid contract that you could enforce. I mean, it doesn't make sense as a contract matter.
It is a contract matter unless you make an affirmative statement given the 365, 360 dichotomy. The fact is that it's not a fully amortizing note. You're implying that it's a fully amortizing note. That's a statute from a contract standpoint says if there's any ambiguity whatsoever, and that's the standard by which we're judging this contract, it one could read it as fully amortizing when it might not be because they have a legal right under that balloon payment under the dragnet clause, then that triggers the issue. If they didn't have the dragnet clause, it wouldn't be a problem. If they said fully amortizing, it wouldn't be a problem. If they listed the extra payment